Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. If you lend us your ears for the next hour, you will find a compilation of stories from our daily VOA Asia programs. 1 week after their dramatic rescue from a flooded cave complex, the 12 teenage members of a Thai football team met with reporters to describe their ordeal. The Wild Boars team members were discharged Wednesday morning from a hospital in Chiang Rai and then met with reporters. Dressed in their team uniforms, the boys filed into the government building and sat before the cameras. Reporter Steve Sanford is in Chiang Rai. He talked with VOA Sarah Williams about that news conference.
They were brought before quite a packed house of media, international as well as the local media, and there were friends and family, officials were also there. Yeah, so it was quite a joyful moment. Kids looked like they were in good spirits. They were laughing and joking. They were kicking the soccer balls around that they had been given by the officials when they came into the town hall, and they looked in pretty good health. Certainly a lot better than 9 days into the cave drama when the British rescuers found them. They were quite thin.
Do medical officials feel that they will be okay or they will have any long-term effects from their ordeal?
It's an interesting question. They basically had been feeding them a lot of healthy foods and bringing them back up to try to get to the level they were before they went in the cave. At the same time, there were concerns about their mental health, which was refreshing to see, I guess, especially in a part of the world such as we are in. They had brought a psychiatrist along to look at the questions, actually, that the media were told to submit yesterday. So basically, the media submitted the questions a day ahead of this press conference, and then the questions were looked over for their sensitivity for the children, and the psychiatrist was also looking at the questions, and I guess they picked from that.
Did the boys talk about their ordeal? I mean, how they kept their spirits up? Were they able to eat any food while they were in the cave, at least before the rescuers found them?
I mean, they had brought some snacks into the cave when they originally went. It was planned the Wednesday before the Saturday practice, according to the coach, and he posted it on Facebook that they were going to go in for a little bit of exploring in the Saturday afternoon following their practice. But they got to a certain point where the water levels were rising and the coach had turned to go back, and basically they realized that they were sort of locked in now from the water. Yeah, so it was basically a plan to go in there after the practice, but it turned out to be a lot longer.
Now, I believe one of the boys speaks English, and he was able to communicate with the British divers that first found them.
That's right. He's quite an accomplished student at the local school in Mae Thai, and he spoke a few different languages. I believe he was one of the team members that was originally from Burma. Yeah, he had a high grade average at his school, and he could speak English. So it was quite refreshing when the diver spoke to the group in English, and then he responded.
Did the boys speak at all about the former Thai Navy SEAL Saman Gunan, who died during the rescue operation?
Right. Actually, they did. In fact, following this ordeal and the press conference, they're planning to be ordained as novice monks for 9 days, I believe, starting on July 26th. And part of this process is to honor the fallen Navy Thai SEAL diver who gave his life while trying to deliver oxygen to the group. So they are quite aware of this situation, and they're going to be commemorating his life with his ordination at this monastery.
And did the coach speak during the news conference?
Yes, the coach spoke quite a bit during the press conference. He was also speaking about some of the regrets. I mean, all of the kids were asked, you know, what did you learn from this experience? And of course, most of them were replying that, you know, they would give more thought before doing something. And in the coach's case, he said that he basically, you know, it was a big experience for him, but he would think in the future more before doing something like this.
Steve Sanford reporting from Chiang Rai, Thailand. Now, this ordeal has called attention to a problem largely unknown outside of Thailand. The north of the country, which is porous, has porous borders and various ethnic groups, is home to a huge population of stateless people, whose numbers range from the official figure of 488,000 to an unofficial estimate of 3.5 million. Of the players, along with their coach, are among the stateless. Three of the players, following the cave drama, Thai officials are considering granting them citizenship. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. President Donald Trump signaled Tuesday there is no timeline for North Korea to achieve denuclearization.
Discussions are ongoing and they're going very, very well. We have no rush for speed. The sanctions are remaining. The hostages are back. There have been no tests. There have been no rockets going up for a period of 9 months. And I think the relationships are very good. So we'll see how that goes. We have no time limit. We have no speed limit. We're just going through the process. But the relationships are very good. President Putin is going to be involved in the sense that he is with us. He would like to see that happen.
His comments come just weeks after his historic meeting. We're talking about the U.S. President Donald Trump with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore, who pledged to work toward denuclearization, but no timetable was agreed upon. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo traveled to Pyongyang earlier this month to discuss a way forward, but the North objected to what it called America's gangster-like unilateral demands. Sung Yoon Lee is an assistant professor of Korean studies at Tufts University near Boston. He told VOA's Victor Beatty it appears to be an unfortunate change in policy, one he calls a defeat and a resignation.
For the United States, that goal has shifted quite dramatically, even violently, over the past several months. It went from within 6 months before the mid-June Singapore summit. It went from 6 months to about a year, and then soon after the summit, Secretary of State Pompeo, I recall, said by 2020, so about 2 years. And then President Trump later on in late June said one has to take one's time with these matters. And now to say that there's no timeline, no time limit, no speed limit, is basically an admission that it's not going to happen anytime soon. So there's an element of despondent self-defeat even in this statement. And, of course, the silver lining, if one can even say that, is President Trump said, well, at least North Korea has not tested a nuclear device or a ballistic missile in 9 months. That's really sad because in the past we have seen 2 years, even 3 years at times, during which North Korea did not test a nuclear device. And, of course, with respect to other powers, nuclear weapons-possessing states like India and Pakistan and Israel, that's never tested. It's been 20 years since either India or Pakistan has tested a nuclear device. And that, of course, does not mean that either of those countries is a nuclear-free state.
Do you see any linkage between the timing of this statement coming a day after Mr. Trump met his Russian counterpart?
Well, President Trump did emphasize that President Putin is on board and Russia will do whatever it can, it must, to help with denuclearizing North Korea. But I don't know, that's such a prosaic statement. Russia's been saying all those things for 25 years or more. It really is kind of devoid of meaning. And I guess President Trump is trying to sell his summit meeting with the Russian president as a success, even on this North Korea policy. But it rings a bit hollow. You know, it's a little sad, I think. In the end, of course, that's playing into Russia's strategy of maintaining the status quo, that is, signing on to UN Security Council punitive measures, resolutions, with each major provocation by North Korea, but not doing anything put any financial or political pressure on North Korea and really turning a blind eye to North Korea's further advancement of its nuclear and ballistic missile capabilities.
Meanwhile, a senior U.S. defense official said the U.S. hopes North Korea will return the remains of about 50 American-Korean war dead within 2 weeks. They would represent the first of perhaps thousands the North has promised to repatriate. Donald Trump, standing alongside Russian President Vladimir Putin, declared Monday he cannot see any reason to believe Moscow meddled in the election that led to him becoming U.S. president in 2016. That statement was walked back somewhat by Mr. Trump later in the week. Every major U.S. intelligence agency has concluded there was such interference with Russia during the election and that the matter is the focus of a major federal investigation that has targeted not only Russians, but members of Trump's election campaign staff. The U.S. president said he did not directly criticize his Russian counterpart over that issue or any other on which Washington and Moscow have significant differences. American politicians on both sides of the aisle, as well as former U.S. intelligence officials and diplomats, began sharply criticizing Trump's remarks even before the president had boarded Air Force One for the flight back home. One nation that most likely was watching the outcome of the Trump-Putin meeting was China. I spoke about that with John Ferguson, director of global forecasting at the analytical firm Economist Intelligence Unit in London.
I think when we think about how China would view today's events, and today's events were quite extraordinary, I think China will see both a bit of an opportunity but also a bit of a risk with what happened today. So maybe we can start with the risk. For us at the EIU, it's been the biggest risk to the global economy since the start of the year. Absolutely, it's the biggest risk to the global economy. And China is right in the middle of it with Mr. Trump disputing over China's technology transfer practices and practices around intellectual property. So what I think China would have been wary with today is they would have seen that Mr. Trump just does things that he wants to do. With Mr. Putin in Russia, Mr. Trump would have had a lot of people telling him to address concerns around Russian interference in the 2016 election and so on. But Mr. Trump plays things his own way, and he's happy to ignore a large range of people who wanted to do something. Now, we think he'll feel a lot of pressure on the trade war with China, basically pressure to pull back from the trade war with China. But as we saw today in Helsinki, he'll do things his own way. And I think, and we think that, you know, countries like China in particular should be worried with how Mr. Trump approaches sort of international relations when he just does things that he wants and doesn't really listen to those around him.
Do you expect to see China make any particular movements or alterations to the way it has tried to handle this so far?
I think China's in a very, very difficult situation trying to work out how to deal with Mr. Trump, especially on trade. They would have been watching today's events in Helsinki, trying to see if there was anything they can learn from how Mr. Putin has worked with Mr. Trump. I don't think they would have learned too much there today. But, you know, I think China will continue to take a bit of a carrot and stick approach to Mr. Trump and trade.
Are there any other countries throughout Asia that this might have had an effect upon?
Yeah, there's a couple of areas. I mean, to be honest, I think there's a few countries out in Asia that will be quite worried about how Mr. Trump is conducting himself. Mr. Trump, I mean, we in the policy community and the sort of analysis community, we talk of something named the international order. Now, this is the order the U.S. has built since the end of the Second World War. The IMF, the WTO, NATO, and so on. Mr. Trump, for better or worse, he is upending that geopolitical global order. So if you're a country like Japan, an ally of the U.S., I think you are very worried. You know, Mr. Trump has shown that on the trade issue, it doesn't matter if you're an ally or not. He's applied steel and aluminium tariffs, and right now he is involved in a dispute with the EU. He's called the EU a foe, and he's applying these tariffs to the EU. So you're a country like South Korea or Japan out there in Asia, I think you are very worried with Mr. Trump's approach to trade and to allies. Because what we've seen from Mr. Trump is that the traditional sort of alliance system that the U.S. has built over decades, it looks like, and he's signaled this many times, that he doesn't take those alliances very seriously. He doesn't care about them very much at all. So if you're Japan or South Korea, I think you are worried that America first, well, as a mantra, as a motto, it doesn't leave much for countries like Japan and South Korea. So there are countries there that should be worried about Mr. Trump's approach to the world.
John Ferguson, Director of Global Forecasting at the analytical firm Economist Intelligence Unit. Nanotechnology researchers at the University of Cambridge are developing an intelligent toilet that might change the nature of medicine. It automatically analyzes a user's urine to capture valuable medical data. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo analyzes the story.
At the Royal Society's Summer Science Exhibition in London, researchers explain the technology might help people self-diagnose conditions, alter medication levels, or perhaps even lower their insurance premiums.
What we want to see is detecting biomarkers directly in your urine to let to personalize the healthcare directly to your home.
The data can be collected far more frequently than occasional blood and urine samples taken by healthcare workers. The results could be automatically sent to a user's smartphone or to a healthcare professional.
Wouldn't be great if moms can detect if their sons are doing drugs or if your premium of the insurance company is lower just because you are giving them access to your everyday health data.
The toilet traps molecules between tiny nano balls of metal inside a small chamber. It's there that they are analyzed using a method called nanogap sensing.
It is just the concentration of molecules within, so the interaction of the molecules with tiny objects, so 2D materials, graphene or gold or silver nanoparticles. So it's when you have high electric fields next to the molecules that then you can enable the lighting up of the molecule.
She says they are still 10 to 20 years away from installing smart toilets in people's homes, but they are excited about the potential benefits such a technology will bring to society. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
The air pollution problem is not going away, especially in much of Asia. According to the World Health Organization, 9 out of 10 people worldwide breathe polluted air, and approximately 7 million die as a result of exposure to it each year. VOA's Tina Trin reported one creative startup has an artistic solution to an ugly problem.
Anirudh Sharma isn't an artist, but he and his team have come up with a creative way to tackle air pollution.
What we are saying is that while the pollution is being released in the environment, why don't you capture it? And once you capture it, make use of that pollution rather than throwing it into a waste stream.
Sharma and his colleagues at Gravity Labs are taking pollutants from diesel engine and chimney emissions and turning them into ink.
We have a plasma-based emission control technology that fits onto the exhaust of the tailpipes of the generators and chimneys. And without affecting the performance of the engine or the chimney, it captures all the pollution that would have otherwise gone into the environment.
Air ink is made of black carbon that has been purified and turned into a pigment base for inks and paints. About 50 minutes of diesel car pollution goes into markers like these. The product takes its cues from history, when the first inks were made from the black soot of oil lamps.
There were mosques that were painted in Turkey by an architect called Sinai, who used to take the lamp black from the lamp that was burnt in the night and write poetry and calligraphy on the walls.
Air ink isn't available for purchase, but through artist partnerships, the startup is taking over public spaces with its own message of environmental awareness.
It's more of a activism tool. It's more of a branding tool. So people believe in it. It gets people started to talk about pollution.
It's an issue that won't be solved overnight. But in places like India, where Sharma is from, it's an attempt to work with a pollutant that's seemingly everywhere.
When you go back to India, you see it in your face. And for us, it did a big thing that, well, how do we utilize this problem as a solution itself? Air pollution knows no borders. It's a problem everywhere. We're trying to bring the technology everywhere it's required right now.
Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. More than 80% of the mosquitoes that spread dengue fever have been wiped out in a town in Australia during a pioneering tropical trial. It's a story we first reported earlier in the week, and the next day from Sydney, Phil Mercer told us more about the results, which scientists say could help global efforts to eradicate the dangerous pest.
Mosquitoes are one of the deadliest creatures on Earth. In northern Australia, millions of male Aedes aegypti or yellow fever mosquitoes were bred in a laboratory and infected with a naturally occurring bacteria that made them sterile. They were then released into the wild near the small farming town of Innisfail in Queensland, 1,600 kilometres north of Brisbane. Over 3 months, they mated with females who laid eggs that didn't hatch, causing the population to fall sharply by about 80%. The type of mosquito used in the trial is responsible for infecting hundreds of millions of people around the world with diseases such as dengue, Zika, and yellow fever. The project was run by researchers from Australia's national science body, CSIRO, in a trial that received funding from Google's parent company, Alphabet. Dr. Rob Grenfell, the Director of Health and Biosecurity at the CSIRO, says the results are a major breakthrough.
Now, this is momentous in the sense that we've achieved a significant decrease in populations of mosquitoes in our test area here in northern Queensland, but also to commemorate the incredible community that actually backed our science here. Not only did they open their hearts and minds, but also their homes to allow our scientists to come in and trap and test our mosquito controlling technologies.
Australian researchers want to test the technology overseas in an area with high levels of dengue. They believe it could be a valuable weapon against a huge public health menace. The World Health Organization estimates that almost 4 billion people in 128 countries are at risk of contracting dengue. The disease is transmitted through the bite of an infected female mosquito. The WHO says that the global incidence of dengue has increased 30 times in the last 30 years. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The plight of nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees continues in Bangladesh as monsoon rains drench camps and raise the possibility of widespread disease. VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren recently made her second visit to the Rohingya camps in 6 months to see if conditions are improving, as some reports have suggested.
You know, I've heard people say that it's gotten better. I didn't think it had gotten better, because you've had more people who have descended upon this area, run out of Myanmar by the Myanmar military, ethnic cleansing, and so it seems more crowded as they try to expand these camps.
And this is just the beginning, and I honestly don't know how these Rohingya are going to endure this day after day after day. Actually, it's hour after hour after hour. There's another crisis. This is just unthinkable. Absolutely unthinkable that anyone could suffer like this. And a million people are all penned in. They're suffering.
But what was even worse this time than when I was there 6 months ago is the monsoon season had set in. And you've got all these people, almost a million people, who descended upon this area fleeing for their lives, and they took down all the vegetation to build shelters and also to use as fuel to cook. So there's nothing there. There are no trees or anything to hold the soil. And they came in, and in desperation, they built these shelters wherever they could first see them, and they built them on hillsides. Well, now comes the monsoon season. And the monsoon season, unless you've been in a monsoon, you never see anything like it. So now what's happening is these shelters are literally collapsing on the shelters beneath them. Then you've got the added problem that there were some latrines that were built on the hillside too. That likewise, those are now collapsing and they're draining, and the filthy water and the feces in the water is flowing down into the water system. And you know that that's a fertile breeding ground for disease. That's how cholera is transmitted, is in filthy water. Everyone seems somewhat jubilant by the fact that half the people in the camp, they've been able to vaccinate for cholera, but half is half a million people, and you've got another 480,000 people who haven't been. And as we got deeper into the camp, we were on a road that got washed away while we were inside the camp by the monsoon.
Let's take a look. I mean, it's unbelievable. This is what they're now going to drive across. Right here, take a look at this, and it has straight down, what, about 50 or 60 feet? Straight down.
While the roads are impassable and even dangerous, how do you get food in there? What if someone gets sick? And these people are living on top of each other. Well, the one thing that's the sort of redeeming quality about this is that, you know, just like we saw with the boys in the cave in Thailand, there are a lot of really good people out there in the world and from all over the world. And to deal with the health crisis, you've got a lot of NGOs that have come to Bangladesh to help out. So there's been an overpouring of help from the world, but you can't meet the magnitude of the challenge. That's the problem. So the good side is you see these incredible people working around the clock, 24/7. By the other hand, is that you look around and you see that there are almost a million people here, and it's just not being handled completely. There's not enough of a world spotlight on this crisis. The UN has called this ethnic cleansing. The United States has called this ethnic cleansing. So this is one of those instances where the world media can use its power and its influence by putting its spotlight on this crisis, which is, frankly, something that we all want to do as journalists, is put a spotlight on, hoping to lead towards solutions, or at least dialogue towards trying to find solutions.
China regards Taiwan as its own territory that may one day have to be conquered by force. China has also criticized Trump administration efforts to forge closer ties with the government of President Tsai Ing-wen. So the recent transitioning through the Taiwan Strait of two U.S. Navy destroyers amid tensions over North Korea and trade created a sharp reaction from Beijing. While the U.S. Pacific Command called the transit routine, a Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman said China expressed its concerns to the United States. William Sharp is a former scholar with the Institute on Taiwan History and hosts an online program called Asia in Review. He told VOA's Victor Beatty, Taiwan appears to hold greater strategic importance to the Trump administration.
The United States is, I think, reached a kind of a point, an understanding that it's ramping up its relationship with Taiwan. It sees increased importance in maintaining a close relationship with Taiwan. We opened the de facto embassy. We've authorized the sale of submarine technology to Taiwan. We have the Taiwan Travel Act and other legislation that's recently been passed by Congress. And we're even talking about posting Marine Guards at the new embassy. I think what it shows here, this transit shows, is the United States has commitments to Taiwan, it has commitments to Asia, and it's carrying them out.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman said Monday that we must state the Taiwan issue is related to Chinese sovereignty and territorial integrity. We urge the U.S. at once to scrupulously abide by the One China principle and avoid harming China-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The truth of the matter is the U.S. has always maintained that the ultimate, how should we say, solution, I'm not sure that's the best word, of Taiwan is to be worked out between players on both sides of the Taiwan Strait. But without undue pressure, undue interference, it has to be a very equitable playing field.
Yeah, the Global Times opined that the U.S. is sending China political signals by sending warships through the Taiwan Straits and apparently said the Democratic Progressive Party on Taiwan has been emboldened by Washington's gestures.
I think that goes without saying. I think the DPP wants a very close relationship with the United States, and it's probably quite some relief to see that those two ships, those two naval vessels, transited the Taiwan Strait. China has ramped up its military missions around Taiwan in recent months, intimidating Taiwan with flying bombers close by, using passages to that go around Taiwan to get to open seas. You know, the truth of the matter is that if the U.S. wants a really strong position in the West Pacific, if it seeks to maintain that, it needs a good relationship with Taiwan. If Taiwan should ever fall into the hands of the PRC, our position in the Western Pacific is non-existent.
The Global Times went on to say, in the future, Washington may send larger ships to the Taiwan Straits, but Washington will not succeed. The mainland's military strength has improved greatly since the 1996 crisis and is capable of countermeasures to deter Washington and the Taiwan administration from provocations.
You know, I'm not sure if it's really advisable for the U.S. to send an aircraft carrier down the Taiwan Strait. I mean, I think it gets a message across using two destroyers. While China has made great military advances, so I believe that the U.S. holds the military advantage.
In 1996, as Taiwan held its first direct presidential election, the mainland conducted naval exercises off the Taiwan coastline, causing panic and prompting the U.S. to deploy an aircraft carrier battle group to the region. Bill Sharp said, however, the more China rails against Taiwan, the greater the resolve of the Taiwan people to remain separate. Thank you for spending some time with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. A newly released report from the non-governmental organization, the Environmental Investigation Agency, uncovers evidence of the illegal production and use of CFC-11 in the polyurethane foam industry in China. The report comes in advance of a meeting of an open-ended group in Vienna, Austria, the Montreal Protocol meeting, where the issue of the rogue CFC-11 emissions would likely be high on the agenda. VOA's Lori London asked Avipsa Mahapatra, the climate campaign lead with the Environmental Investigation Agency, how this was all uncovered.
I will maybe start with the May 2018 study published in Nature, where scientists found that surprisingly and inexplicably, they were seeing that CFC-11, which is a potent ozone-destroying gas and has been banned globally since 2010, was somehow showing up in the atmosphere in significantly higher quantities than expected. The scientists concluded that it must mean that there is some new illegal production of CFC-11 occurring somewhere, and they could narrow it down to East Asia without pinpointing a single country. And as Environmental Investigation Agency, we have been working in the Montreal Protocol, which is the international treaty that deals with refrigerants and that was created to deal with the ozone hole problem. And so we immediately started our investigations into what might be happening, what could explain this. And in a nutshell, what we found was shocking even to us, because we found evidence that of the 21 companies we reached out to and got a response from, 18 companies spread across 10 provinces in China openly claimed that they are using CFC-11 for building insulation purposes, mostly.
And this is an illegal substance?
That is correct. CFC-11, because it harms the ozone layer and it causes ozone depletion, its production and consumption, along with four other CFCs, was written right into the original text of the Montreal Protocol in 1987. So CFCs were officially banned in developed countries in 1996, and in developing countries by 2010, it's not supposed to be there.
Do you just do the investigations and then you turn it over to another body, or how does that work?
That is absolutely correct, yes. So EIA we are a non-governmental organization. We don't represent a company or a country. So we are an independent campaigning organization. We presented our findings to the government of China so they can take enforcement action. And we are also going to present our findings at the Montreal Protocol, which is the international treaty that all 197 parties of the world are signatory to, which is the environmental treaty and the body that deals with ozone-related issues and gases under it.
Similar to the Paris Climate Accord?
Somewhat similar, but even stronger than that, because under the Montreal Protocol, there are specific gases that the global community has agreed to ban, and there has been, over the many years, there are institutions and bodies that have implemented these bans. There's a financial mechanism that is associated with it. There's a non-compliance machinery that is also associated with the Montreal Protocol. Because this was developed back in the 80s, over the decades, all these institutions and mechanisms could be put in place, which the Paris Agreement is now starting to work on.
Mm-hmm. The violation, it's by China's foam industry, not China's government, correct?
That is correct. That is correct. However, there is what the Chinese government now has to figure out is every single country in the world has to report to the Montreal Protocol what is getting produced and what is getting consumed in their country. They're required to. And all parties to the Montreal Protocol have been reporting near zero new production and consumption since 2006, which is why when the scientists found this in the atmosphere, their immediate question was, well, if all the countries are reporting zero, where is this coming from? So what we are asking the Chinese government to do now is to ensure that, you know, not only do they take action against these specific companies that we have identified and their networks, but also to conduct a comprehensive nationwide review of the sector and investigate beyond these identified factories to make sure that there are penalties for using and producing such banned substance that would deter offenses in future.
This, I'm assuming, is an environmental crime. How big of a deal is this?
This is a massive environmental crime, and if illegal CFC-11 use continues unabated in this sector, as we have identified, our calculations, you know, by 2022, for example, we are looking at as much as 700 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. So that, on an average, is equal to the carbon emissions from 16 coal-fired power plants every year.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Many of you no doubt followed the World Cup, which has ended in Moscow with France defeating Croatia 4-2. While Pakistan is not a soccer powerhouse, there is a strong link between the country and the sport. A lot of the credit goes to the city of Salkat, where about 40% of the world's soccer balls are produced. Many wonder how a small city in northeastern Pakistan can compete on the global stage in manufacturing high-quality soccer balls. VOA's Saman Khan visited several factories in Salkat to learn more. Behzad Hamdard narrates.
Salkat has become a hub for factories that make sports equipment. So much so that one company here has the sole rights to produce the official soccer balls for the 2018 FIFA World Cup.
During the World Cup, the demand increases from our regular customers and by association. We also get new customers as well.
And more orders mean factory workers are very busy.
Whenever World Cup comes around, we get a lot of work, more orders. We have to give more time. Salaries double. We get great wages.
We make around 40 million soccer balls in a year, but in a World Cup year, we easily reach approximately 60 million. Salkat exports roughly $200 to $250 million in footballs alone during the World Cup.
So, not surprisingly, factory workers here feel a sense of pride as they watch the World Cup matches.
When the soccer ball made by us with our own hands is used in the World Cup matches, we get very happy.
With so many sports equipment factories in Sialkot, competition is fierce.
You have to work hard. You have to communicate with customers and negotiate prices, and only then can you win contracts.
Child labor has been linked to some of these factories in the past. But according to a local representative of the Independent Monitoring Association for Child Labor, or IMAC, companies are working diligently to please their clients and make sure their factories meet international standards.
Factories make the FIFA licensed balls, and many make quality balls, so it is very important for them to become IMAC members. Their clients no longer look just at factories' child labor rates. They also want to make sure they are socially responsible.
The global attention on the World Cup series has been a boon to Sialkot's sports equipment industry. Business is booming, unemployment is low, and people are moving here from other parts of the country to take advantage. Some say it's too bad that the World Cup happens only once every 4 years. For Saman Khan in Sialkot, Pakistan, this is Behzad Hamdard, VOA News.
The game of basketball is finding fans in an unlikely place among young Tibetan Buddhist monks in the northern state of Himachal Pradesh, where many monasteries are nestled along verdant Himalayan slopes. Anjana Pasricha had the report that several monasteries have changed centuries-old traditions and allowed the monks to play sports.
After a morning spent in prayer and study at the Palpung Sherabling Monastery in the mountains of Himachal Pradesh, it is time for an invigorating game of basketball for these young Tibetan Buddhist monks. 15-year-old Setin Bhutia loves the game.
Without playing, there's no fun.
The monastery's principal, Kempo Pema Negi, explains why some monasteries have relaxed old traditions and built courts.
Doctors in ancient Indian texts say it's very important to play games. Then the earlier rules were changed and games were openly allowed. Now they play without fear. Games relax the children's minds and make them sharper.
Sherdub Wangji says sport must go hand in hand with studies.
It is like yoga. I won't become fat if I jump well.
At the basketball court in Bir Biru Sakya, another monastery in the vicinity, the game keeps young monks happily engaged. 12-year-old Funga Namgyal loves the sport.
I'll become taller and more flexible.
But that is not all.
I'm really happy when I score a goal.
For this 10-year-old, the game is simply fun.
When the bigger men have the ball, I like to snatch it.
Jigme Thinle, who teaches Buddhist philosophy at this monastery, enjoys coaching the young monks in the game, which has become his favorite since he learned it in college.
The child monks who are the whole day in class, this gives them some activity and mental happiness. In class too, when it is about to be 5 o'clock, they must be thinking of basketball.
Sports have come to stay because monks now believe they contribute to the goal of a calm mind and happy life.
If your body is healthy, your mind is healthy. And if that happens, then your life is healthy.
On the courts, some monks score a goal, some miss. Some prefer just sitting with a book or watching. And as prayer flags flutter, the game acquires a gentler aura on these Himalayan slopes. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Himachal Pradesh.
World health officials were stunned when the U.S. opposed a resolution for countries to encourage breastfeeding, especially when decades of research have shown its benefits for both mothers and babies. VOA's Carol Pearson spoke with two prominent doctors who fully support the UN resolution based on scientific studies and explain the benefits and risks of breast or bottle feeding.
Millions of babies around the world would thrive if they received mother's milk for the first 6 months of life or longer. The findings come from the largest and most detailed study yet on the benefits of breastfeeding. It was published in the Lancet Medical Journal 2 years ago. The study showed breastfeeding could save the lives of 800,000 babies per year. Pediatricians say while women should have options, science is clearly on the side of breastfeeding.
The science of breastfeeding has been established for several decades.
Breastfeeding improves nutrition, decreases infections, and is cheaper than formula.
We know that right after birth, when the mother puts the baby to breast, the baby gets the colostrum, the early milk that the mother produces, and it's very high in immunoglobulins that protect the baby from infection. And then continued exclusive breastfeeding continues to support those health benefits for the baby.
For women to use infant formula, clean water is a must, not just for the formula, but also to clean the bottles. The nipples and spoons used to measure the formula must also be clean. If not, the baby can get diarrhea, which can be fatal. And because formula is expensive, if a mother tries to stretch it out, the baby will not get enough to eat.
The benefits of breastfeeding are extraordinarily high to be able to protect against these illnesses.
Breastfeeding also has clear benefits for the mother as well. For one, it reduces the chances that she will hemorrhage after giving birth. Doctors say women need to be supported by their physicians, by their families, by their communities, and by their employers in order to breastfeed their babies successfully, to give newborns the best chance at healthy lives. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Intricate design, white flowers, see-through veils. A happy bride proudly wears her perfect wedding attire. It's white and made from toilet paper. June is a popular month for weddings, so the recent 14th annual Toilet Paper Wedding Dress Contest took place in June in New York City. As Elena Wolf reported, the entry shocked the jury with the elegance and chic one doesn't usually expect from hundreds of rolls of bath tissue. Anna Rice narrates her report.
Only the sound of rustling paper reveals the uniqueness of this wedding dress contest, as finalists proudly show off their somewhat fragile gowns.
This dress is worth 250 hours of hard work and 32 rolls of toilet paper and 23 rolls of scotch tape and lots of glue and a very loving, helpful husband who cooked while I was busy gluing.
Susan Nicholson is from Georgia. Next year, her daughter Bianca is getting married, and she knows far too well how much wedding dresses can cost. And although Bianca decided against sporting a paper gown on her own big day, she's helping her mom put together some paper jewelry for the contest.
The necklace is the same thing. It's with the toilet paper too. I love it. It's beautiful.
The jury takes the contest seriously, and the standards are very high. Out of the 1,500 submitted entries, only 10 dressmakers made it to the finals. But their creations are truly amazing, especially considering that they were allowed to use only toilet paper, glue, scissors, duct tape, and thread. The idea of a contest featuring disposable, chic, but definitely not easy to produce wedding dresses first occurred to founders of the wedding website Cheap Chic Weddings 14 years ago.
I got to tell you, from a distance, you can't tell if it's the real thing or what. I mean, the product itself is so good that it as we looked at many of the dresses and seeing unique uses of it, it's just amazing what many of these designers are able to create.
Corsets, lace, hats, and veils, toilet paper masterfully used at the contest never looked so good. Contest winner Roy Cruz says he spent hours and hours on this veil.
In one square, I spent like 1 and 30 minutes every night. So my sister told me, oh, my God, do you think you're going to finish that? Oh, I'm going to do this.
And the winner is Ronaldo Cruz.
But all his hard work paid off. The contest winner gets $10,000. So Roy, who last year lost his job as a florist, can now fly to the Philippines and spend some quality time with his family. Still, today's finalists are not destined to be worn. Since the contest started, only one dress ended up at a real wedding. The bride just made sure the weather on her big day was nice and sunny. Anna Rice for Elena Wolf, VOA News, New York.
Thank you for being with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. Japan and the European Union signed one of the largest free trade agreements Tuesday that covered nearly one-third of the global economy and over 500 million people and eliminates nearly all tariffs. It followed a visit to Beijing by EU Council President Donald Tusk and European Commission head Jean-Claude Juncker, who have been preaching open global trade and against what they call the conflict and chaos of protectionism. The EU-Japan Economic Partnership Agreement is the culmination of 5 years of negotiations. Their respective parliaments must ratify the pact, which is expected to come into force next March, about the time Britain leaves the EU. J.P. Morgan senior economist Masamichi Adachi in Tokyo told VOA's Victor Beatty this will give a boost to Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's economic priority of reigniting the world's fourth-largest economy.
He's pushing this free trade agreement to many countries, including this Europe. And he's sort of now trying to be a protector of a free trade world against the attempt by the President Trump to block the many areas. So for Abe, it's for the promise to the own people and also to the international community that he's now trying to prevent the protectionist move in the world.
This covers one-third of the global economy and more than 600 million people. This is a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a big deal. But of course, you can argue that it's not the 100% abandon of the tariff or something. It's still a managed agreement, which is probably better than the blocking and threatening other counterparts.
This obviously goes against the trade tensions that involves the U.S. and other parts of the world over trade policies. Obviously, Japan is not going along with these trade restrictions or trying to avoid them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, both European and Japanese wish to maintain the sort of progress of globalization, especially the trade activities. Therefore, it's ironical that U.S. President Trump's attempt to block borders, which actually pushing closer relationship between Europe and Japan.
The two EU leaders, Mr. Juncker and Mr. Tusk, just arrived from China, where they held talks. Obviously, they're going through Asia and see that's great opportunities there.
Yes, I think the even without trade tensions in the world, Europe and Asia both wanted to have a more close relationship. So for the European side, probably this is a very important time to persuade leaders in Asia, including Japan, to continue this effort to maintain this free trade world.
Is this trade deal a substitute for what was called the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
It's not a substitute. It's a supplement, I think, because the TPP is, Pacific regions, and the EU and Japan is, over the Eurasia, Asia. Over the Asia. So, I'm talking about the continent of Euro-Asia. Therefore, regionally, it's actually supplement, not objecting each other.
But the TPP is going ahead, you say?
Yes, that's what the Japanese government want to see. I mean, the Japanese government and the Prime Minister Abe is definitely pushing the TPP-11 and eventually will invite the U.S. back to a game.
The Trump administration withdrew from the TPP shortly after taking office in 2017. Both the TPP and China's Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership already involve many countries in Asia, including Japan. There is a saying that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. That refers to a growing inequity gap. It is present in the United States, as in many other nations across the globe. However, the results of a new study on the topic might surprise many. It shows Asian Americans are the hardest hit by inequality in the United States. I spoke with Rakesh Kalchir, the senior researcher for the Pew Research Center and the chief author of the study.
Our main finding is that income inequality in America varies strikingly from one group to another. Today, inequality we find is greatest among Asians in the United States. And this is the result of a near doubling in income inequality among Asians from 1970 to 2016. And in this process, they displaced blacks as the most economically divided group in the U.S.
This sounds surprising because when people in the United States, as we have both talked to many of them, think of Asian Americans, we think of very well-established and financially successful people. So what happened?
Now, it is true that on average, they are better off than other groups, but our research presents a more nuanced picture of the diversity in this population.
Such as?
So what we find is, first of all, as we noted, income inequality is the highest within this group, and it has also increased tremendously in the last 4 to 5 decades. And this reflects the diversity and origins of this population, which is still principally driven through immigration. Since 1970, 80% of the growth in this population is due to immigration alone. And these immigrants have come for a variety of reasons from a variety of countries. They range from people who are here for reasons of family reunification, or they came as refugees following the end of the Vietnam War. Or more recently, they came under the more skill-based visa system, the H-1B visa program, to work in the technology sector or the healthcare sector. And then there are others who came here for graduate studies and have established successful careers in the United States. So this diversity is reflected in the diversity of their economic outcomes.
Now, how much of these numbers and do these findings correlate with the increase and the greater number of immigrants from Asia to the United States?
Well, they correlate in the sense that this is a population in transition. It is rapidly changing. Just in the last 20 years, the population has doubled, and it has increased 14-fold since 1970. So it is a population demographically in rapid transit, and what we are seeing is the picture of that transition at the moment. What it looks like in the future as the second generation and the third generation come to settle and into the labor market and we see their economic outcomes, that's something we cannot predict. But at the moment, we're definitely in a phase of transition.
Is there a geographic definition as to those doing well and those not doing so well?
Well, if you look at this by country of origin, a few things we do know. This is from related research, not in this specific research of ours, that some groups such as Indians, for example, or people from the Philippines or Japan, they are among the better off among the Asian American population. Their education levels are high and their incomes are high. On the other hand, at the other end of the spectrum, people not doing well include the Hmong and the Cambodians and the Bhutanese, poverty rates approaching as high as 33% and incomes also on the low side. And that correlates with relatively lower levels of education among certain groups.
Rakesh Kalchir also said financial inequality is on the rise at a very rapid pace in the United States. He said it is higher and increasing more quickly compared to other G7 nations. We're very happy you're with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. Remember to learn more on all of these stories on our website at voanews.com. Indigenous elders in Central Australia are leading efforts to save a critically endangered language. Bill Mercer in Sydney tells us of the estimated 300 Indigenous languages that once existed in Australia. Only 90 are still spoken.
Language is a critical part of Indigenous culture in Australia. It's a repository for tribal knowledge, history and customs and gives communities a valuable sense of identity. About 300 languages existed when European settlers arrived in Australia in the late 1700s. Although around 90 have survived, only about 60 are considered to be alive and in regular use. Others are considered to be critically endangered as tribal elders pass away. Academics say that colonisation has also had an adverse effect on Indigenous languages. In the Central Australian desert near Alice Springs, only 20 people are fluent in Potame, but children are being taught its ancient words in the hope that it won't die out. Community leaders say that for decades they were forbidden by their white teachers to speak their native tongue, but they did so in secret to help it survive. Tribal elder Kathleen Bradshaw.
This teacher walked past and said, "Do not speak that lingo at school." And we promised ourselves that we would talk it in secret and just keep it going and, you know, talk amongst ourselves in secret. I think a lot of non-Indigenous people, they do not understand how important it is for Aboriginal people to have their language and to keep it strong.
The Northern Territory in Australia has schools where students learn in both English and an Aboriginal language. Many communities speak what's called Aboriginal English, that reflects Indigenous language and culture. Its structure adheres to some patterns of standard English, as well as including words originating from Aboriginal languages. Creole is a North Australian Creole that's spoken by children whose parents were fluent in different tribal languages. Aboriginal Australians make up about 3% of Australia's population. They suffer high rates of poverty, ill health and imprisonment. Archaeological evidence has suggested that Aboriginal people have been in Australia for at least 65,000 years. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Simple, tiny, noisy rooms in a hostel would seem like a place most people would rather not stay in overnight. However, rooms just like that are drawing in guests as a tourist attraction in Japan. VOA's Deborah Block explains what makes tiny hostels so popular.
Trains clatter on a viaduct just above the rooftop of Tiny's Hostel in Yokohama, Japan, the country's second most populous city. Recently, This downtrodden section of town with a red light district was cleaned up to make way for revitalization. And 2 months ago, Tiny's Hostel was born. Its three simply furnished rooms are actually tiny trailer homes on wheels. There is no TV, but there is free Wi-Fi. Each room has a private bathroom, shower, and an outside deck. The rooms can sleep up to four adults or a family of six with small children.
I was a little apprehensive before coming here, but once I saw the place, it looked really nice, and I was surprised by how well thought out everything was.
The rooms are named Wonder, Discovery, and Silence, despite the noise from the trains, which usually run until midnight. But the trains were the main reason this woman came with her family.
We immediately knew we all wanted to try staying in the place with trains passing above us, and we booked it as soon as we could.
The hostel manager says the best compliment Tiny's receives is when the guests are departing.
At checkout, we see everybody leaving with a smile, and that makes us happy.
Deborah Block, VOA News.
I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Please join us next week for another edition of VOA Asia Weekend.